Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Can we get serious now?
One thing that did happen during the 60s was some music of an unusual or experimental nature did get recorded and did get released. Now look at who the executives were in those companies at those times. Not hip young guys. These were cigar-chomping old guys who looked at the product that came and said, I don't know. Who knows what it is? Record it, stick it out of it, sells, all right. We were better off with those guys than we are now with the supposedly hip young executives who are making the decisions of what people should see and hear in the marketplace.
Success in the music business begins with a dream, a vision. This podcast will give you, the listener, the insight and tools to turn that vision into a reality. Meet the industry professionals who work day by day behind the scenes, helping to make those dreams come true. Welcome to the business side of music.
Sitting across the table from me today, the gentleman I have met previously, his lovely bride I just met today, but I've been following your careers for a while, I should say maybe your career as a duo, as a group. Hemp and Denim are with us today. Hemp Meadows, Denim Sky, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bob. Glad to be here.
I love what you had to say when we actually met at a big party a few weeks back out at Johnny Cash's farm, which, by the way, is a bit of a drive from Nashville, let me tell you, especially at night on that two-lane country road in the dark.
Exactly.
But you said something when I mentioned that I'd been following your music, love what you guys were doing, and you said, this is a business, and we treat it as such. And I thought, okay, got to get you on the show. We're going to talk about that. But first of all, let's back up. You two met a few years ago.
We met in Hollywood about 38 years ago.
Doing session work?
No, we bumped into each other backstage at a Cars concert. We were both back there for different reasons, and we kind of bumped into each other and took a look and went, all right.
Baby, you were the reason that I was there.
Well, it was fate.
I was looking to meet someone just like you.
Really?
I was so excited when I met you.
And it worked.
Yeah.
It worked. Yeah, it stuck.
Yeah, it really did stick.
It was a one-night stand.
That's lasted for
33 years.
What a great story.
With some time off at the very beginning, after a couple of years in.
Because she figured out who you were.
Well, you know, when you're attracted to a bad boy, there's, you know, the bad boys of rock and roll. You love those guys. But they're fun for a weekend or for a while or whatever, but then they have their ways.
It's the bad behavior. You like the bad boy, but not the bad behavior.
And it was Hollywood.
Yeah.
And it was Motley Crue and the Sunset Strip and, you know, Van Halen and that era. So it was pretty wild times.
You were both musicians, singers, songwriters. What was your gig?
Well, my gig was, actually, I was an artist at Tiger Beat magazine.
I remember Tiger Beat.
Yeah, down in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Used to work for Tiger Beat and Rona Barrett's Hollywood.
Oh, my gosh.
As a graphic artist.
Boy, for any young
Pre-computer.
Listeners, you got to look those names up.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think Tiger Beat is still being published.
And Rona Barrett, she was kind of like...
Right,
she,
exactly.
Yeah. She had the hammer in that town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she could make or break your career.
And your offices were right on Hollywood
Boulevard. It was a fun job because I got to meet all the teen idols. They got me doing makeup on them.
So who was your favorite? Did you have one?
A favorite teen idol?
Yeah.
No, I was too old to like the teen idols at that time. But
which one stuck out more than
Leif Garrett stuck out because he was not a small little guy. He was like a hunky guy.
Yeah.
So he was very interesting, and his sister was also an actress. But I did makeup on quite a few people during that time frame, even record executives and Ricardo Montalban. I did his makeup one time. I did Johnny Rotten's makeup for a photo session.
He could have used it.
He could.
And a toothbrush.
He had a little red dreadlocks, and what I did, I stuck paper clips on them so they stuck straight up. It's pretty fun.
All the secrets of the industry.
From Ricardo Montalban to Johnny Rotten, that covers a lot of territory.
That does.
Right.
That's pretty much the full spectrum. What about you?
I was involved in the music business as much as I could as a singer-songwriter. And I was working back in the day at a stereo store on Hollywood, right across on Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset, right across from Tower Records. It was a really heady time. I mean, that was a rock and roll time when Tom Petty was really big right then. Fleetwood Mac was really big, and I had the opportunity to work for a music store after that, and I wound up packaging projects for REO Speedwagon and for Queen, Bowie, and for Prince. As a tour manager, formerly, you know, you have these requirements that come in for gear and equipment and everything that have to be a manifest that comes in and has to be fulfilled. And then sometimes you got to meet the artist and sometimes you got to meet the management company because they were usually the ones that were buying it or whatever.
And you said it, that was a heady time because when you talk about Hollywood back in those days, it was, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning at Tommy's or it was, you know, Carney's or whatever.
Well, there's so many different things. I mean, everybody was there. You know, John Lennon was there in town at that time, and you know, Pink Floyd came into our record store to listen to The Wall on what they felt was going to be a home stereo, you know, as a reference and stuff like that. So you'd have those kinds of interactions with people where they're in the building kind of stuff, you know. So I wound up selling equipment, and then somebody heard about me. Roger Lynn found out about me and hired me to introduce the LM1 drum machine, which was the first computerized drum instrument that was out there. And from that, I had the chance to work with a lot of artists because they were needing, I mean, this was right at the time when electronic music was getting started, and the drum machine was definitely the thing that was happening.
And you two got together, but not so much musically back then, more as a couple, or?
Well, that's kind of, that predates us getting together.
Yeah, then I had a little deal with A&M Records as a production agreement with one of the producers there, Henry Louis. So Denham joined me in the band at that time, and we had a group that also had Michael Steele that left to join the Bangles.
Right.
She was in my band before she was in the Bangles, but they had a record deal, and they had stuff going on that I didn't have, so they left. And then, you know, one by one, musicians come and they go, and they got better offers to do different things. We met backstage at a car show, and it was lust at first sight.
You really were kind of ground zero, though, for a lot of those acts. You know, you brought a lot of people together, and they went off in different directions. And that's probably a cool way to look at it. It's once again, it's that kind of that groundswell that you create, and you get yourself into the music business at an early age. And what I love about when I read your bio, where it says an intoxicating blend of 60s and 70s California pop and British rock. You two have really started something here, I guess, what, in the last few years, Hemp and Denim, which is this really, for people of my generation, is one thing because you're taking us down memory lane with that style of music. But then there's a whole new audience coming and listening to your music, too, of a very young generation. How did that all get started?
I think it wasn't anything conscious. It's just that it's the way Hemp writes. He writes the songs and they come out that way. And then it's just our vocal blend, the sound that we have that's unique, the way we sing together. And then our producer, I'd say, would be the third element.
If you had the opportunity to actually grow up in the 60s and you could hear Hendrix, Cream, The Who, The Stones, The Beatles, all of those bands and, you know, a million others, their first records would come out. Led Zeppelin, their first album came out. It was revolutionary. It was the kind of thing that would just blow your mind. Your whole world would change.
There wasn't an oversaturation like there is now where there's so much music that it's really hard. Back then, on the radio, you would hear all these genres at the same time.
Thank you. And I think that's what you say.
Particularly on AM.
When you talk about oversaturation, and it's oversaturation really of kind of the same style. And back then, you're right, it could be Joplin or Hendrix or Grand Funk Railroad or Chicago or Cream or whoever it was.
Right, and one after the other.
And it was all their...
And then some Motown acts mixed in right
Carole
on top
King
of that.
Yeah. And that's something that I think we miss.
Well, it wasn't commercialized, it wasn't homogenized. It was being invented at the time. It was very artistic. It wasn't algorithm driven.
The artists seemed to have their own identity. They weren't like formed by the backers or whoever was.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And fashion and politics and everything that was going on was being driven by music, and rock and roll was just, you know, kind of in its own adolescence. It had been invented in the 50s. Came of age in the 60s and kind of matured in the 70s. So by the 80s, it had become pop. After that, you had grunge. You had a little bit of the Johnny Rotten era with, you know, with punk through there as well, too. There was some great music. I mean, The Clash is one of my favorite bands of all time as well, too. But we were all growing up, and it was all being invented simultaneously. And the Woodstock generation kind of came of age, and kind of it was the first time that an audience of young people actually came together. in force.
Could you imagine today 400,000 plus people gathering on a field for a free concert? I don't know if we could ever do that, what they accomplished in August of 1969.
I know. It's just shocking to watch the films of it.
Yeah.
It's so thrilling. I didn't go to Woodstock. In fact, I wasn't very fond of large festival-type things. I still aren't.
Quite a few festivals leading up to Woodstock weren't that successful. They didn't have the luck that Woodstock did, which was, let's face it, it was peace, love, and music, and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, of course. But a lot of festivals had problems fighting or, you know, riots or just... But Woodstock had such a great vibe to it. And you mentioned something that you lived in Laurel Canyon for a while.
I did.
Which to me was such a melting pot of, you know, the Jackson Browns and Linda Ronstadts and all of that great element, especially in the 60s and early 70s. It was such a great time for music.
Well, I wasn't up there during that time period, so I didn't run in those circles. But it was being up there in Laurel Canyon was pretty cool. I had a little studio apartment I was renting from an older lady who was an actress named Bunny Bernhardt. And she was just a really interesting person. And I had that little apartment when I met him.
Well, Laurel Canyon Boulevard has got, all those acts that came out of there, it was just a hotbed of creativity. It's a unique time. It wasn't invented. It just kind of came to be like that.
So when we talk about your music, which is that melting pot, musically, who influenced you more? You named quite a few acts.
And you did too. I mean, we covered the whole gamut right there.
Was there one that stood out more than the other?
No, when I was a kid,
growing up, I was so heavily influenced by Chicago or Santana.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, when I built my first band, I said, I got to have a horn section, but I got to have a lot of Latin percussion too.
You
don't make any money with a 12-piece band.
Right.
But man, we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Was there any band in particular that just stuck out that you wanted to emulate your writing style after?
Well, I mean, when the Beatles came out, I was 10 years old. That was just, that was ground shaking, man. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand. And it was just like the freshest, most vibrant jolt of electricity that you could ever imagine. And it was raw and fresh and real, and it was completely different than anything else. And then they just kind of kept on going. So I think the Beatles were preeminent, but then that just opened the floodgates for all the other bands that came out of England. And so I just kind of just absorbed everything from The Who, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, all the acts out there, the Zombies. And of course, there's all the singles that happened from bands that were not necessarily bands, but that were, you know, just great single artists.
Well, I think with Hemp's always had a very unique sound. Here's something that's amazing, Bob, is vocally, he sounds the same now as when we first met and we had that, we did that recording at A&M. He virtually, his voice is the same. And I think it's wonderful because it didn't get blown out or ruined or, you know, his hearing is good.
Yeah.
He didn't, you know, listen to too much loud music. And so it's kind of given us a fresh feel to the music, I think, because of the energy that's there. The way it comes out is like the way he writes them, they're just like almost full blown. You can almost hear them in your head how they're going to be produced. And we have a producer that's on the exact same wavelength as we are, and it really gets it, Jim Frazier, and he's fabulous.
That's so important when you find, and you said it's that third component, when you can find that piece that fits so well. And I know that in my time in the studio producing mostly country artists or Americana, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but you really need to kind of get ahead of that curve. So if you found that producer that works for you, it's just going to make your role as a singer-songwriter and as the recording artist going in the studio, it's just going to make it that much better.
Yeah, that's right. And it's such a unique relationship. It kind of, like you said, it either works or it doesn't. And to find somebody that can fulfill your artistic vision the way that you're kind of imagining it in your head is so awesome. And to know that you could write anything and that they can produce it.
It's interesting because usually when Hemp will take in a new song, he'll have it all worked out and take it into Jim, and they might listen to some records, or Hemp will say, I kind of like this sort of a moody blues feel on this, or I want this to be more, you know, Springsteen-ish or whatever, but they kind of decide how they're going to do it. One of the things that we were very conscious of is didn't want the tracks to be so complicated or that it wasn't something we could perform live. We've really gone in with that idea that we can pretty much play them live the way they are on the records.
We're going to take a little break, get a word in for a couple of our sponsors here. But as we do, if you don't mind, I'm going to play one of the cuts off, I guess, your self-titled album, Hemp and Denim.
Yes,
here.
We were Hemp Meadows first, but Hemp was so sweet. He said, no, honey, you need to be on the records too. So
it wasn't because I was so sweet. I know who's the star of the show.
Well, we know which
it's
one I'd rather look at.
Exactly.
You know, of the two. No offense. We're going to take a break, but as we do, we're going to play the track Follow Your Heart off the self-titled Hemp and Denim album. Who are here in the studio today?
From the veranda, we watch the sun go down without a sound on the ocean. These emotions might not ever come again. I look in your eyes, and to my surprise, I see my world stretching out before me. I feel so free, I never wanted to end. You've gotta follow your
You're listening to the Business Side of Music.
Hi, everyone. I'm Larry Butler, and I want to send you a free digital copy of my new book, The Singer-Songwriter Rulebook, 101 Ways to Help You Improve Your Chances of Success. That's right. Everything you need to know to launch your career as a singer-songwriter, all based on my 40 years in the live performance arena. And believe me, I've seen it all. In my book, you'll find the 10 things you have to deal with before even thinking about becoming a singer-songwriter performer. You'll also learn about the 5 things every singer-songwriter can do this weekend to make their live show better. 5 things I can guarantee that you are not doing already. Plus, there's tips on songwriting and staging, photo and video shoots, publishing, merch, dozens of other topics, all written for people who don't particularly like to read. And again, it's free. Just go to the Business Side of Music website homepage and look for my book cover. Click on it, and a free digital copy of my book will be yours. I'm Larry Butler, and I approve of this message. Thanks.
You're listening to the Business Side of Music.
Back in the studio, Hemp Meadows, Denim Sky. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
During the break, we were talking about the first album, I guess, Hemp Meadows, is the You Can't Fool Karma.
Mm-hmm.
You said it's a hemp and denim project. I mean, her voice is on there. And you said she helps you take it to the next level.
Well, we have a unique relationship in the fact that creatively we can collaborate as vocalists. She doesn't get involved in the writing side of things. That's kind of what I do. But she's a great critic and a great ear to be able to listen to it. It's fantastic to be able to, you know, have her encouragement and her inspiration. And she's basically the inspiration for almost all the material that I write, one way or the other. Comes back to you, baby.
Thank you.
When you write the songs, are they story songs? It's obviously she's, from what I can tell, she's your inspiration. But is it something that's happened in your lives? What
I don't really write a lot out of personal experience, and you can't write. You know, I've written a few love songs for her, but, you know, you just can't continue to grind.
Because after
a
while, you become a Barry Manilow or, you know, a Neil Sedaka.
Oh, Lord, let it happen. 73 million records sold.
Yeah.
I look at writing more as a writer, as opposed to, like, I need to chronicle the things that are going on in my life. I'm in a different era of life than I'm on top of the hill looking over the hill as opposed to on my way up to the hill.
Yeah.
And so I have a different adult perspective. And so it's more, I try to craft the songs in a way that is polished and professional and yet still my heart and my feeling, because I want the passion to show through. And I write out of passion for a musical idea that's generally generated by just beat, rhythm, and chords. The sound of the music generally inspires a feeling that you want to get lyrically into some kind of a concept or an idea. The song has to evolve out of itself, I think. And ultimately, you don't know what it is that you're going to be writing, but things start to come together. And then do I really have an idea that's worth pursuing? That's the next thing, because it takes so much time and energy and focus to be able to take an idea through the different stages that it has to go to. It might take, you know, dozens of hours of work to see if it's even worth taking to the next level.
When you describe that process, do you work on just one song at a time, or do you have several songs in the queue?
I think most songwriters have a few things that are knocking around in their noggin. Yeah, I've got like 3 songs right now. It's real easy for me to write the music. It's the lyrics. Because the music is rock and roll. It's not that difficult in regards to, you know, I can put a band together and we can do what we do, because it's more nuanced in terms of rhythm and beat and there's subtleties and stuff like that. But I don't play complicated music per se, but it's filled with heart and passion, and it's very melodic. I really try to have great, strong melodies and big hooks. The other thing I always want to have is I want to have provocative lyrics that grab a listener from the very, very beginning, because I've only got 5 to 10 seconds to get their attention. And if I don't create some kind of a compelling situation or location or something that's going to, some even a phrase that might grab their attention and hold them, they'll be gone. And so trying to move a song through that process is it's a deliberative craft type of thing. And I've worked, it's like Malcolm Gladwell says, there's a, you know, 10,000 hours to get good at something. There's a lot of truth in that. I've worked really, really hard at becoming what I consider to be a professional songwriter. that I have stuff that's worthy of being produced and that I have song that's worthy of being listened to, and that if it is produced right and it is listened to, that it does have an effect upon your feelings and you're going to feel better than when you first started listening to it. Because I want to create emotional healing through my music, whatever it is.
That's a great concept. I love that. And I think music, a lot of it is designed for that, especially, once again, going back to our generation, our era. A lot of music, especially during those troubled times of the 60s and 70s, the Vietnam War, a lot of that music was a cathartic healing process that we all had to go through. Mm-hmm. I think we're missing some of that these days.
And it
days.
Also unified people in that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, and the artists were more like, we felt like they were on the front lines fighting the fight. You know, living the life and sending, you know, a message back to us that this is their musical message. And it was so illuminating and it brought everybody together.
What I really like about Hemp's writing is he doesn't let something go that's just good enough. He'll always go down deeper and work until it's really something
really
good.
Keep making it one better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really hard. But the first song that I did that we recorded was a song that I was kind of inspired by the movie That Thing You Do with Tom Hanks. And I just loved that era of music. It was just, that was an early rock and roll incarnation. And it was kind of like the Beatles in a way, that same era. And I thought, you know, that's so inspiring. I want to write a song kind of like that of the thing they do. And so I wrote this song. I got it to a certain point where I felt like it was really, really good. And I took it in to demo it for Denim. And when I did, she said, really good, dig deeper. And lyrically, that's almost what she always says. So now I don't even have to bother. I just know she's going to say, there's another level in there. Keep working on it. So I just kind of start with that idea in mind right now.
But that's good that you have someone like that to bounce it off of, which I think a lot of songwriters could use. Maybe you should, you know, offer your services out there for other songwriters too, because sometimes the truth hurts, but we need to hear it. And especially when you are crafting a song, I've said this before on the show, Brian Wilson was a perfect example of whatever it is you record in the studio, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but when you record it in the studio, it's going out there forever.
Mm-hmm.
So you better put your best effort, your best embodiment of work together now.
And I can say this, I'm really proud of this, Bob, is that I can go back and listen to any of my songs and derive a tremendous amount of enjoyment as a listener from listening to my own material. Now, that sounds kind of weird, maybe, because there might be some people that say, I never go back and listen to any of my old stuff. Yeah. But I truly enjoy getting high and listening to my music, because when you have the opportunity to know that that song is basically, for what it is, perfected. You didn't leave anything out. It's all done. There's no mistakes. It's just all the feeling is there. The mix is there. The mastering is done. And it's just, it's great to be able to go back and revel and enjoy your own work, your own art.
Well, the thing is, it's not really old, because we only started recording 2 years ago. We started that first Hemp Meadows album 2 years ago. So that's basically how long we've been working on this project.
And you have two of them out now.
Yeah.
Two EPs, and we've got another EP half done.
Yeah, we've got three songs recorded and three more to go. So, yeah, we've been doing one a year, six songs. You know, that's about every 6 to 7 weeks we got a new song in the studio.
You've also treated this as a business, which a lot of artists, entertainers get out there and they don't. They just say, I'm going to go in the studio, I'm going to record something. Do you have a game plan when you started this process 2-3 years ago?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we realized that we hadn't been in this business since like the early 80s. And it was
completely. And a lot's changed.
Completely different. It's not the same business on any level. And so here we are now. And, you know, we're at a different age. We're at a different era. Commercially, is it even viable for someone at our age group? No one has done this. No one has come out of nowhere as a senior adult of the era of the baby boomers and out of nowhere come out and become broken as a new artist. I mean, the Stones, the last time they had a top 40 hit was 40 years ago. You know, the Who has released two records in the last, I mean, they're having the 50-year box set stuff for the band right now. You
right.
know? So no new material has come out, and certainly not the best material of their careers. So we're starting out at this as like brand new artists. What do we have that we can offer the marketplace? What is it that we can do well? And how can we approach this where we can afford to be able to do it and stay in business? And we know enough about business to know that you've got to make more money than you spend, but you got to be willing to spend some money. You have to invest in your own career. So we figured out what we felt like that was going to take. We put a budget together, and we weren't that far off, actually.
Pretty close on everything we've done. And, you know, they say Nashville's a 10-year town, but we don't have 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a big hurry to do what we're doing, figure out how far we can get, how fast,
mm-hmm.
so we can actually play a lot of shows and get the music out to people, because so far we're just a secret. We're not even streaming.
What's been the reception so far?
Oh, people love us.
From what I've been following, you've been selling out where you're performing.
Yeah.
And you've got a band that's traveling with you. It's just not the two of you on stage. You've got quite the ensemble backing you
well,
up.
Well, I started out doing open mics, you know, because I said, you know, I've got to get back in the groove. I started playing guitar again. I was horrible. I had no skills. I was beyond rusty. I was just ridiculously bad. But I kept at it. My fingers got a little bit more, a few blisters on them, you know, and I got to a point where, you know, I could, out of 20 minutes of playing, which is about as long as I could play, there'd be, you know, 4 or 5 minutes that sounded like halfway decent, like enough to encourage you, like you're playing golf, you hit the one shot that keeps you in the game, you know. And so I started doing that, and then I got to a point where I felt like I was doing pretty good in my bedroom, you know, with my acoustic guitar. Of course, this is being Nashville, and it's a very weird thing to say you're going to put your boots on and throw your guitar in a case and head down to a, you know, an open mic around this town. I mean, there's a lot of talented people out there, and you find out real fast if you've got, it's like being a comedian and stepping on stage. You know, it's just you, and it's your material.
And you're bearing your soul.
Yeah.
Do you have the chops to be able to accomplish
this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you have the drive? Do you have the willingness to go out and bomb?
He would go out 3 nights a week. It was a lot of open mic.
Every week.
Yeah.
And every time I went out, there was something weird that happened to me that was completely off the list of things that I didn't know could happen to you when you're on stage. But after a while, you go, you know, I'm starting to get a little bit more comfortable here, a little bit more sense of myself on stage, who am I, my persona, if you have one at all, you know. What music, I mean, the first time I went out, I was so scared, I couldn't even hold my guitar. It was just terrible. I forgot the words to 2 out of the 3 songs I had to play, and it was embarrassing. But there was one guy there, Gary Cavanaugh, I don't know if you know Gary, but he's an old-time songwriter, and he saved my career because he said, "Hemp," because I went up afterwards, I said, "I am so embarrassed, I forgot the words to the songs." He said, "Don't even worry about it, man. It happens to all of us, and we hope you come back." And if that's the community part of Nashville, if he wouldn't have said that to me right then, it would have been, I was filled with so much shame. I just was looking for the back door to slink out of there. But because of his few words of encouragement, I came back and stayed with it.
We're going to take another break. Come back. We're going to talk a little more about the business side of what you two have accomplished and what's next with Hemp and Denim. And as we go out, we're going to listen to a cut off the You Can't Fool Karma. In fact, let's listen to the title track here. Hemp and Denim on the business side of music.
You can't fool karma.
Ooh. Yeah. You think the world can't get along without you. Remember, you're only passing through. And everything you do and say becomes the dues you've got to pay. That's why they call it the blues. Oh, you might be a big tycoon on Wall Street. You might be the president of the United States.
The president.
You might be a famous movie star. It doesn't matter who you are.
Karma, she don't make no mistakes.
Whoa.
What's that sound? You check the nickel down when the karma comes down. It ain't for any deeds I found. When the karma comes down, you can be a millionaire.
It ain't about the money.
What's that sound? You check the nickel down when the karma comes down.
Oh, 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 maybe I told you so.
You can't fool karma.
of compensation when the only thing you need is self-respect.
A little respect now, baby.
'Cause everything that you do, well, it all comes back to you, but in ways you might not always expect.
People think their deeds will never find them. To them, nothing matters but success. But mister, don't you know, it doesn't matter where you go,
karma's always got your address.
Wow, I just joined the Music Starts Here community. This is a truly hidden gem for anyone in the music business. Whether you live in Nashville or anywhere else in the world, Music Starts Here is like a GPS for your music career. This is the place to be if you want to get advice and direction from some seriously talented musical people who have been where you want to go. Music news, events, and a great big community with resources for artists, songwriters, musicians, studio and tech, along with music business advice from pros in the industry, all on one site. Make sure you get your free profile now. Go to www.musicstartshere.org. That's musicstartshere.org.
You're listening to the Business Side of Music.
Back in the studio, Hemp Meadows, Denim Sky, more commonly known as Hemp and Denim, are here in the studio with us today. You two have created something that a lot of other people probably wouldn't have the guts to do. And I think, Denim, you said something, you know, we don't have that 10-year plan. A lot of us don't have that 10-year plan at this point in our career. We've been doing this for a long time. We've got to get in as much as we can in the short window that we have. You two doing this type of music, and when I say this type of music, it's that blend of 60s and 70s, your original material, which is something else that a lot of people, I mean, that's a big leap of faith that you got to do. And you talked about before the break, getting up on those open mic nights and, you know, let's pour some gasoline and strike the match. It was that bad. But you keep moving forward. And when you talk about this as a business, you want to get into this and make some money, but you also want to have fun in the process. You have to, it's a balancing act, isn't it?
It's a balancing act. And, but one of the things, Bob, we decided to do is we're treating this as if we're going to be hugely successful. So in other words, we've copyrighted the songs. We have an entertainment attorney that we've hired. We've trademarked Hemp and Denim and Hemp Meadows. So we've got all laying the infrastructure of bricks in so that when we do have a chance, we've got all that together. We have an LLC, Hemp Meadows LLC. That's how we pay
everybody.
We have
a publishing company.
A lot of this, so much is common sense that a lot of people just don't think about doing.
Well, they might think about it, but, you know, we've got a little bit of money for, you know, that we're willing to speculate.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're willing to do what we need to do to make progress. So we have the two EPs produced. We've got 5 music videos we've produced. We did 34 episodes of a podcast that we did. And we're producing a live video from the show we did this last Saturday of one of the songs. So we video. We always try to do as much as we can when we do something. Like last year, we went to Florida for vacation. And I said, let's shoot a music video while we're in Florida.
I remember that. You did it on the beach, if I remember right. Yeah,
it was a lot of fun.
It came out great, and you know, it allowed us to deduct the expenses and gave us more product and content, because that's the one thing is you're always having to create new product and content.
Yeah.
But I'd say the most things we're definitely still completely in the hole on everything, but the one thing that seems to bring in money is ticket sales. So it seems like the live shows are where the money is.
We talked about this on a previous podcast episode, and that's exactly almost what's left anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're selling CDs, and that's part of that merch world that you take with you in every venue, but it's selling those tickets and getting in front of a live audience and building your fans.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that when Denim was kind of going through the litany of all the different things, so we tried to establish going in, we realized we had to set ourselves up as a business, get in position to do business, and that the investment that we were willing to make was in ourselves. And if you're willing to invest in anybody, it should be yourself, albeit the entertainment business would be, I would never invest in the entertainment business with anyone but us, because I don't have a clue about anybody else. I don't know what's going to be big or what's going to be good.
Well, and when you talk about investment,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can get into whether it's real estate or stocks or bond markets. The music industry, or maybe I should say the entertainment industry, is about as high of a risk as you can
get.
It's
the highest risk. And we look at it as the entertainment industry as well, too, because we recognize that we have a unique ability to entertain people, and we wanted to put a show together. We wanted to build a brand. We wanted to have to develop our personalities in such a way that there was an identification with our audience, which has turned out to be the baby boomer generation. And what's been so cool about that is that there's been a lot of people that have been inspired by what we've done because they want to do it too with their spouse. They'd love to have a creative relationship, husband and wife, to be able to go off in the second half of their life and be able to fulfill their dreams. And is there a way we can marry those up? You know, we have different ambitions and stuff, but, you know, just beyond traveling or playing golf, is there something we could actually build together and create and have fun doing in the time we have left? And that's what we decided that we wanted to do, because the greatest joy we have is being on stage with each other. I have no greater joy than seeing Denim enjoying herself on stage with the lights on her. She's a star. And to see her being able to perform and to listen to her voice with what we're able to do together, we're just starting to unfold another level of our relationship in front of everybody on stage, surrounded by these musicians that are taking our music and making it live on stage. And that was one of the parts of our business plan, was we realized there's only two ways to make money that I figured out in the music business, and that's either having a sync license on TV or the movies or a commercial, or selling a ticket. And so I tried to set myself up with, if those are the only two revenue streams, then that's where I need to be doing business, because there's no business to do anywhere else. So how can I get involved with both of those? I had really no control over getting a song in the movies or on TV or something like that. But I did know that playing live was going to be a key for us. And I knew that it needed to be more than just the two of us. I'm telling you, I had no idea what it was like to try to put a band together in this town. The quality of players, I mean, if you're really, everybody's so good, you're out of town on a gig, you're touring, or you're already booked. It's a revolving door of people that you have to become familiar with over a period of time, and your music has to be good enough for them to even want to do it, because even if you've got the money to pay their rate, they don't want to be involved with you unless it's going to be something that's a feather in their cap or a good point on their resume.
Or a good time.
Or at least a good time.
I was going to say at least have some fun in
yeah,
the process.
Yeah, and they want to play your music because they love playing your music. Yeah. That's the other thing, you know.
Well, one of the things we did with our plan, Bob, is we've concentrated completely on Nashville. We figured why we're in an entertainment city. Let's do all of our marketing, all of our outreach, all our shows, everything. Just keep it here in Nashville. That way we can have the economy of scale where we can do the Facebook advertising or stuff. If we were trying to do nationwide, you know, obviously right. We can't do that.
Yeah, it doesn't help to have 5 people in Sacramento and 3 in Austin and 2 in Kansas City. We wanted to build an audience here.
You're building a hub and then create your spokes out from that.
Right.
Absolutely, to get that wheel.
And we also knew that it's such a convention city that why not let the people come to us, just like Vegas? You know, everybody wants to go to Vegas. Everybody wants to come to Nashville. So if you've got people that are coming into town, if you can perform for that crowd, I mean, they all leave and go back home, and they leave as fans.
Yeah.
And plus, you have a never-ending source of people, not only local, because you only have so many people locally that'll turn out to see every time, so you need to have fresh audience.
And if you can put a CD or a T-shirt or
they'll
any
buy
other,
that because yeah. it's a memento of an event right. happened in Nashville. They want to take that home.
So we've been having just the time of our lives. I mean, so much fun. It's the excitement of doing a show and being on stage. The show we did Saturday turned out great. Everybody really had a good time. And just to know that you've affected people in a way that makes them happy, you know, it just is really, really rewarding.
I think that's another key component is people leave and they're happy. They've made good memories.
And that was the best part was everybody said we had a wonderful time. We had a great night, you know, because people have, last night's a perfect example. We went out to see a movie last night and wound up spending, you know, $68, you know, $30 for tickets and a couple of drinks. And if we would have had dinner, it would have been a $100 ticket to see a movie.
A movie.
So we could have sat at home and watched Netflix. That's your competition. It's not other live music. It's not bands. It's Netflix. It's all the things every other distraction that somebody has. So for them to get in their car or get a babysitter or to do whatever they had to do to be able to come out to see you is a big deal.
It is.
It's
and you want to make it an event. You want to make it a moment they're going to remember.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And one that we'll remember, too, that it's a fun party and that you're part of it. So
I think for people that are wanting to do a project like we're doing, it is worthwhile to make a budget, to figure out what you can afford to spend on recording, what you can afford to spend on promotion. You know, there's printing.
Great point, because is there any reason to actually produce a CD unless you're going to have a promotion campaign behind it?
Yes, thank you.
See, one of the things that I have friends that have gone in and they've spent a bunch of money recording at a really nice studio to come up with their EP or their album or whatever, and they maybe sell 20 or 30 copies.
Because they have no marketing budget or promotion budget behind them.
That's right.
The funds to get that piece of product out there. Because once again, what you said, it's not just Netflix. You get 500 channels of television.
Yeah.
And you have 5,000, 10,000, whatever the numbers of other artists doing the exact same thing. How do you leapfrog in front of that? You got to market yourself. You got to promote yourself.
Yeah. And you have to figure out what brand do you actually have.
Yeah. And who's your audience?
And who's your audience? Because one of the things I realized about the internet is that you don't have to have everybody in the world. You just have to have your tribe. And if that's, you know, out of 6 billion people, if there's got to be 20 or 30,000 people that would be digging what you're doing,
yeah.
if you're any good. It's just how do you find those people? You know, that's a whole nother episode right there.
We're working on that.
In regards to marketing. But, you know, we know exactly how much money we would like to make out of our business. And we're not looking to get extremely wealthy, but we want to pay our bills and be able to have have a lifestyle of being able to perform our music, hopefully around the world at other people's expense, because they want us to come in and be there. That would be the dream come true, right? So why not dream big?
Well, if you keep doing it, it'll happen.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
What else is going on?
Well, right now what we're doing is we have just finished up doing this show, and these shows are they're a big deal. We sold out. We got a standing ovation. and we had the time of our lives. So we're going back in the studio because we've got other songs. We have had a song that did get picked up for it's a web series, a TV show on the web that's really been successful. And so we're following up on that. We just want to bring the show to more people on a bigger level, play bigger venues.
Because there's a point where you start to make money.
Your expenses don't really grow.
Our expenses are more than what we're making when we do a show. But you realize we need to play a place that's twice as big. Then we would break even.
Right.
Three times as big, we could pay ourselves, too.
Right.
So that's kind of...
You actually pay yourself.
What a concept. How can they find you?
Well, you can find us on, follow us on Facebook, Hemp and Denim.
Which is how I found you.
Yes. We also have a website, hempanddenim.com. You can see all of our music videos on the website, and we also have our podcasts are posted up there. You can buy our CDs. You can buy our merch. We also have a line of CBD we're playing with, too. So we have Hemp and Denim CBD you can buy.
Yeah, we had so much great results personally with CBD that we wanted to be able to provide it to our fan base because it's all part of, you know, making people feel better. Yeah, it's a lifestyle type of product because it can be used in so many different ways. And like I said, we've had personal results with it. And so we wanted to, you know, expand our ability to be able to touch people's lives in a positive way by making it available under our own signature line. So we sourced it directly. We looked at companies in Colorado and California and Michigan and ultimately wound up choosing a company that's located here in Nashville. 100% organic. It's a fabulous, fabulous product that we're really happy to be able to make available to people.
And I've got a bottle of it right here in front of me.
Yeah.
Try it out.
Yeah.
So like us on Facebook and go to our website and give us your email and we'll keep you posted on what we're doing.
And listen to your music.
Listen to our music foremost. Yeah,
that's the main thing.
Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
I really enjoyed it.
The Business Side of Music is the creation of Tom Sabella and Tracy Snow and is produced by Bob Bender. The Business Side of Music is recorded at Music Dog Studios in Los Angeles, California and Nashville, Tennessee. Production sound designed by Keith Stark. Voiceover and promo by Lisa Busan.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
When's it gonna start?
I don't know. When's it gonna end?